hello once again, and welcome to the third pilot of Polycast, the official podcast of a Bolton Civilization site. I'm Dan Q, known as Dan Q on the forums. Yes, I did that on purpose. In real life, known as Dan Quick, and with me is Imran.
Yes, that's me.
Finally.
And that's my my actual name. It's not just some cool alias I thought up of, in case you were wondering.
It's cool?
Rumors are dispelled. And there, saying it's cool is Wouter Snyders, known as Locutus on the forums.
Yep,
hello.
That's me. Hello.
And making sure this podcast doesn't become too dirty. Or something.
Too late.
That's not my job.
Standards and practices, we have them?
Is Makalua, who prefers to go by Mackie. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, welcome to another edition of Piloty Goodness.
Ooh.
You like that?
Yeah.
Yes.
What begins with F and ends with UCK? What are you guys laughing for? It's fire truck. Your minds are disgusting.
What do you mean? That's exactly what I was
thinking.
All
the listeners aren't going to think of that.
This week in the news, the Civilization franchise continues to perform well on North American sales charts. Civ 4 Warlords patch coming in October and the expansion nominated for a BAFTA award and the how and why of expansions, Galactic Civilizations 2 Dreadlords and otherwise. The Senate is then in session to deliberate slavery and pop rushing, farms or cottages, forest cutting, and city raising in Civilization 4. The final item on the agenda is the latest edition of the Modcast, exploring game models without artificial intelligence or AI, the next Civ War expansion, and improving the game's naval aspects. Let's now open the door to the news department. For the month of August 2006, the Civilization franchise did well in sales charts in North America. The top six of last month's ranking is dominated by only three franchises. World of Warcraft is on top of the chart as usual, while the number 2, 3 and 5 are claimed by The Sims 2 and two of its expansion packs. The remaining two places are for Civilization 4. The original game climbed 7 spots in the chart compared to July landing in 6th place, while the expansion Warlords rose to the 4th spot in the ranking, 12 places up from the previous month.
It's a good thing. You know, Dan keeps buying, his 30 copies a month, and, Civilization just stays up by the top of the rankings.
Well, it's so easy when a Polton Plus makes $30,000 Canadian a year.
What is that, like 20 American?
Is that 20,000 American or just 20?
20.
Just checking.
I see the World of Warcraft is once again on top as it has been.
Once again? I think it's been top since it came out.
Yes, well. And The Sims has 3 of the top 5. But in spite of all that, I think Civilization 4 has done pretty well hanging up there. The original game, up there in 6th place, and Warlords in 4th. I don't think you can be too disappointed in that one, especially considering the huge amount of regular news that, World of Warcraft and The Sims get in terms of mainstream news sources.
Oh, yes. World of Warcraft, I never picked up this crack habit. Sorry, Mackie. Maybe Philip Coates could write an article about World of Warcraft, and it's too many clicks. Hey, Phil? What do you think?
Oh, if he thought that was too many clicks, wait till he plays World of Warcraft.
Yes. And The Sims, besides offering a venue to create some semi-interesting and often amusing machinima, I'd rather see this Brethren of the SimCity series go vamoose, but... with all the money that it's raking in and mindless expansion after mindless expansion, it's hard to argue with economics when you're looking at the bottom line.
And I was going to point out, all the money that The Sims keeps raking in is the reason we're going to get something like Spore.
Well, you expect me to thank The Sims now?
Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, you will thank them.
Okay. Thank you, Sims.
I think we need Joe Lieberman to come out and say how violent Civilization 4 is and how it promotes genocide. Maybe we can get some good press that way. We can get the gangster purchases. That'll shoot us right up the charts.
Oh, very funny. Pun intended? Shoot us right up the charts?
No, but I'll claim credit for it anyway.
You better make sure you ask for some royalties if they use that.
Indeed. If you were wondering why there hasn't been a patch for Civilization IV Warlords yet, and if it's still coming, wonder no more. The good news is that Firaxis designer Alex Man Nazaris announced in our forums that a patch is in the works, some time ago actually, but we missed it. The bad news is that it won't be released before mid-October, not because it isn't ready yet, but because of scheduling issues with quality assurance.
Well, this, you know, this patch coming in October, there is no reason to panic. The time to panic is when one patch comes out after another, after another, after another, either because there's so much to correct that it cannot reasonably be packed into one release, or one patch breaks more than one that it fixes, so it has to be patched itself. Breathe.
I concur. I think it's a good thing that they're taking their time looking at all the problems and sending out one, and not just rapid fire sending out one and then finding out that it broke other things and, you know, have to send one out the next week or something like that. So, it's a little bit of a wait, but I think it'd be worth it.
It works for me because it'll probably be, the patch will be out there and ready about the same time I get Warlords.
Yeah, I know, and the fact that Take-Two Interactive's QA has such a taxing schedule
anyway,
at the moment.
You said that it's a good thing that they're taking their sweet time, but I'm not sure if that's the case, because they're not really working on the patch. They're just waiting for QA to get caught up. They're having some scheduling issues.
Oh, well, why don't we try to be a little more optimistic? You know, like I said, you can be pessimistic and say they're inefficient or incompetent or a combination thereof, but you know what?
Those are your words.
Perhaps it sounds like this publisher's QA is learning from a hot coffee incident.
You never know what that crazy Sid Meier is going to put in these games.
Speaking of which, in 2008, get hot coffee on the Sugar Cream expansion pack in one title. Hot coffee, the latte edition with extra foam.
It's so wrong. Civ 4 Warlords has been nominated for a BAFTA award. The British Academy of Film and Television Arts is an organization that supports, develops, and promotes the art forms of the moving image, among other things, by annually handing out awards to the best films, television makers, and games. For this year's edition, Warlords has been nominated in the category Strategy, along with Age of Empires, The Age of Kings, Football Manager 2006, Medieval 2, Total War, Rise and Fall Civilizations at War, and Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter. The winner will be announced at a ceremony to be held on October 5th.
Ooh, they're getting a BAFTA award. I didn't even realize they gave ones for computer games.
Yeah, that was my reaction as well. I mean, what the hell?
That's because...
Aren't those like no Oscars?
Perhaps this is just a North American perspective, but, you know, I hear BAFTA... I know you were founded almost 60 years ago, but when I hear BAFTA, I can't help but think of NAFTA.
And then,
what's up with that?
And then Dan thinks of crazy illegal immigrants or something. Because, you know, we're all invading Canada now for the good health care and jobs. Us being the United States.
Yes, you're aliens from this planet.
Yes.
Ooh.
We're taking your jobs.
Eh?
Well, I did notice you said a boot. Yeah, quite add some local flavor to the broadcast. I approve.
You know, well, I like hearing that Warlords was nominated. And then I guess it's just me. I've never been a supporter of categories of game awards where expansion packs and base titles mix, particularly in cases like BAFTA, where one of the eligibility requirements states, and I quote, "Any game is eligible so long as it has been or will be released during the calendar year January 1st to December 31st, 2006. Warlords is not a game. It's an add-on to a game. Now, I'm as dedicated Civ fan as I possibly can be, so I hope Warlords wins. But otherwise, okay, taking that out of the equation, if it can't be Warlords for whatever reason, I'm rooting for Rise of Fall Civilizations at War, again, given BAFTA's eligibility requirements.
I'm curious how that works that Age of Kings is in there. That's like 3-4 years old or longer now.
Yeah, it's been released on the Nintendo, I think.
7 years. Okay, this is not a PC title. This Age of Said, Age of Empires, Age of Kings. It's one for the Nintendo DS. Okay, bleh, to consoles in general, but Nintendo? Nintendo? You know, and as I said, wasn't this, you know, this was released as Age of Empires 2, the Ages of Kings 7 years ago, as we've been getting at. Ooh. Ooh.
That's okay.
I think it's even sillier.
Yeah, it's going to lose anyway, right?
This that Medieval 2 Total War is on that disc, which isn't even done yet. So they're just going to guess this might be a good game. Go so we're going to give it a award.
And what is Football Manager 2006 doing here as a strategy?
Yes, Baff, to hold your head in shame.
It's a strategy game. It's a sports strategy game.
That is a strategy game.
And it's a sports simulator.
And it will probably
That's an
win.
Insult to all other titles in this category, even that tactical shooter Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Okay, well, if they're going to argue for football thing to be strategy, I'm going to argue for Ghost Recon to be strategy.
Yes, it's not just a first-person shooter. It's a tactical shooter. I'm putting Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter, whew, mouthful that is, ahead of Football Manager 2006.
That's Football Manager 2006?
Why would I want to?
Oh, it's a North American type of bias here.
I don't lose interest at the football or the 2006. I lose interest at manager. I go,
It's a very strategic game. I think it belongs. It's also in simulation as well. It could win both. Wouldn't that be nice? Oh, and it's in
Pick
sports.
Pick a category and stick with it, you category hustler.
It'll probably win all three.
Three? Oh, we're a player.
CG Online Dark Avatar Interview. Gaming site Computer Games Online has conducted an interview with StarDark founder and president Brad Wardell about the upcoming Galactic Civilizations 2 expansion pack Dark Avatar. He talks, among other things, about the lack of copy protection, the rationale for digital-only distribution, and the storyline for the campaign game. He also discussed the new gameplay features in the expansion, the customization options, and how the patching process for the Gal Civ series works. Finally, he says that
there will probably be a second expansion pack, but not anytime soon. I have no idea what would be in that. That's a pretty far off into the future. As for Galactic Civilizations 3, I'd be surprised if it came out this decade. There's a lot of expandability in the Gal Civ 2 engine.
Interesting comment Brad makes in discussing why Dark Avatar will be distributed digitally only and not through retail too. Talks about, 75% of our unit sales are at retail. The majority of our actual revenue comes from digital distribution, quote-unquote, because of the costs associated with getting titles onto retail shelves. He notes that they were able to put more money into features or the expansion itself than pay for space and dust collectors. Kudos! But Brad, don't talk about a probable second expansion for Gal Civ 2, please, before you have the first one out the door. That will make, I think, too many people hesitant to buy the first one, asking questions like, will the first one not be complete? Will it be too insignificant? You're better off to have said just what you said in the next sentence about a Gal Civ 3 not likely coming out before 2010 because of the expandability of the Gal Civ 2 engine. Quote unquote, now you're talking.
Well, the first thing, I think the whole online distribution thing is a pretty good idea, especially for developers who, kind of are wanting to cut a little bit of their cost by just putting it online instead of having, paying for all the unnecessary stuff. A lot of people throw away boxes, or, I don't, but I know a lot of people do, and I have bought games by download, so a couple of games, actually, more like sports simulation type of games. So, it's a pretty good distribution model. I mean, you have a company that has e-licenses, and, I think it would definitely, help out smaller game developers who could, cut costs on putting the little box on the shelf and just get it directly to their fan base.
Yeah, it's great for the independent developers that way, because then they don't have to, they have more profits, so they can keep working longer on it, and as he's saying, do so many more expansions off of their one engine, because in the first place they had more time to develop the engine.
Not just that, it's also whatever you call them, shops, just aren't going to put games on their shelves if they don't sell at least, he named the number in the article, I think it was something like 150,000 copies. And independent developers often aren't even going to sell that many. So they don't really even have a choice. So this really opens up new avenues for people to develop more smaller scale games for smaller markets.
StarDock president Brad Wardell has written an article for IGN on why and how of expansion packs, focusing specifically on the upcoming Galactic Civilizations 2 expansion Dark Avatar.
He explains to the reader by crunching some numbers why most games don't do expansion packs, why Dark Avatar will only be released through TotalGaming.net and not in mainstream retail outlets, how big of a budget the Galaxy 2 expansion will have available, and how it will be used, including why it won't add multiplayer support.
And in an even more recent development to this CG Online article, Brad talks about the results of a contest held at some other Civ site, which doesn't really color GalCiv otherwise, but anyway, very cool, and how some of the works submitted were so impressive that not only is StarDock going to give away more in prizes than they originally thought, but that some of these suggestions are going to influence the Dark Avatar expansion. Excellent. That's nice to see. And nice to say.
I mean, I thought it was interesting about announcing the second expansion after the first one, the point you made earlier. And I don't think it's necessarily too bad of a thing. You know, a lot of people, especially, say, when they bought Civ 4, realized that there was going to be more than one expansion pack afterwards. I mean, it wasn't like some surprise.
Yeah, and if you had to try to do something like that with Civ 3, you would have had to wait, 2 years before you could have had the whole game together? People are not so patient that they're going to wait for all the expansions to come out first.
Most importantly, Brad also announced that he's really using a tiered system. If you wait for the second expansion, you get the whole thing, but you pay a little bit more money. And the expansion packs are going to be considerably cheaper than you might ordinarily be used to. So, in the end, you don't even pay all that much more.
And in the IGN article, first back to some of the numbers, the number I mentioned about the 75% on the unit sales at retail, Brad says to IGN that, quote, nearly half of their revenue on GalCiv 2 came from digital distribution channel, TotalGaming.net. Brad, how is that a majority?
Well, if it was 51%,
you said nearly half.
That's a majority.
Nearly half.
Yes.
That should be less than 50%.
That's true, if we're following the English language rules.
Yeah, and here Brad writes that expansion should bring more content to their parent titles, but more importantly, bring new features. Shake things up. I agree entirely, particularly considering that some expansions to games, even in recent years, some of them, you know, feel like more like works packaged into a pay-for product that could be downloaded for free with a paid broadband internet connection at home, or at work if you're lucky, I suppose, and as long as you pay your bill, which reminds me.
If you have any news for us, any news tips, contact us with news tips.
Head on over to apolton.net/about, look for contact us, or news@apolton.net also works.
And you can also PM.
Yes, you can. Locutus, DanQ, Snoopy369, and Illuminatus. One of us four will get that up there.
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy. The first topic for today is slavery and pub rushing. How useful do we think it is? When do we use it and when not? And what do you think are the implications of using slavery, the moral implications of using slavery in a game? So what do you guys think?
You know, for the longest time, I didn't, you know, it was the moral thing. I didn't want to do it. And then I had been over at Realms Beyond, and they have one of the epics over there where it's Raging Barbarians on Deity. And if you don't whip, you are so dead. I mean, you are dead, dead, dead. And did I mention dead?
I think so.
So I have now learned that in it's not a bad thing. I mean, you have to look at it. I try to use it for things that I know are going to last a long time, like a library or something like that, so that if I do have to do that, they're contributing to something that's going to last and not just wasting them away on 20 million units.
Yeah, I see this useful only in those situations that are rare, although I suppose if you're playing in that situation, it's not so rare, where there are, you know, items that need to be rushed for your own survival, you know, military units, for example. Though, you know, as I said, could conceivably be agreeable to rushing other buildings, as you said, such as a library. So when you crap the whip and piss your citizens off, at least you're getting some kind of benefit out of it.
That's why I said long-term buildings.
Well, I was just rephrasing it for anybody who might not have understood.
Oh.
Well, I think I have to agree with Dan there. You know, you got to, you know, only use it when perhaps your survival is on the line. And as for the moral implications, I think a lot of people probably, you know, look at slavery and say, well, I don't want to be a slaver, but, you know, history of the world has shown slavery to be a quite common thing. And I figure, you know, they should include that and, you know, why not?
Yeah, it seems appropriate to use it to do something like partially rush the pyramids or something like that, but when it gets later in the game, it feels more, well, I mean, less appropriate to be using it on things, because you're more enlightened now.
Yeah, you know, and if you can, make sure you have one or more religions, maybe preferably a state religion, and happiness resources as well, and as I said, unless it will mean your demise, if you can, wait until this rush will only cost one. Then do so, you know, help minimize that pissed off factor. But I did notice this interesting strategy from Ben Trafkin in the thread on Appleton's forums over at appleton.net/forums. Wasn't that a nice plug? I thought that was very smooth. Of course, it's not now that I'm explaining it, but it could have been otherwise.
Almost.
Not very subtle now either.
Almost. Where you can create settler factories, build a granary in the city if it doesn't already have it. Doesn't take that long to acquire the technology to build, doesn't cost that many resources to build. Build something that is neither settler nor worker, so the city grows. Whoosh! There's my whip sound. Woo! Special effects. Build worker settler, and then repeat from step two.
Works for workers, too.
Build either worker or settler.
Oh.
If you're in need of reducing a city's population because, you know, it's too far above the happy cap, then remove a worker from a food-producing tile or two and see if you can reduce your turnly, I don't even know if that's a word, but now it is because I said so, turnly food production to a preferred level. And, you know, you can do this multiple times if you see a need for multiple population reductions in a city and, nomad populace! Except perhaps the moral implications. I know that was the other part of the question. And I think, generally speaking, when it comes to slavery and pop rushing, most people have a different opinion of using it in-game as opposed to, say, the real life.
I, for one, definitely don't have moral objections. I see it, if it's a gameplay mechanism that's profitable, then I'll use it. And it's definitely very, very profitable. If you have certainly a high food value, say 3 or higher, the math just works out. It's usually you gain more from it than you lose from not having that extra pop for a few more turns. So I'm quite a active slaver, I'd say.
Well, when you get one of those crazy multiple floodplain cities, it's really worth it.
Yes.
It grows back almost before you can.
Well, even if you have just one or two grain resources or something like that, those give 6 food, I think. So that really helps.
Yeah, and with your settler factories, you know, once you build a worker or a settler, add the usual surplus carryover and the cooling off period you'll get anyway from settler builder worker time, and away you go again.
Yep, and it gives you an extra city, and that will make up for the resources you lose from sacrificing a pup.
Yeah, and the earlier in the game you do this stuff, the more impact it has on the whole game.
And about the moral implications, I mean, this is a game where a lot of people want to conquer the world, so.
Yeah. No one has any problems raising cities.
Yeah, I mean.
You're killing dozens of pop at a time there.
Yeah. And you had nerve stapling in Alpha Centauri, which a lot of people did. So, in the end, I think some people may react just to the name of slavery, but I think a lot of people get over it.
If you sacrifice a pop, it's one thing, but if you sacrifice a beer, you know, some people might get really annoyed.
Gee?
Only the Guild of Beer Brewers. Although, wait, they'd be happy. They could brew more now.
Oh, and also keep an eye on your unit maintenance costs. You don't want to pop rush yourself right into the red, unless you like that. Do you like that? Is that good for you? The red.
The red calls to you, precious. That was supposed to be a golem voice, but I did very badly.
think I'm getting scared.
Of who?
That's a good question.
You should always be scared of Dan.
Well, he does have banning powers, so it's very easy to be scared of Dan.
You want to be banned? Like that?
Be very afraid now.
What have I gotten myself into?
That's what we all said the first time.
Yes.
So we now turn our attention to farms or cottages. Which do you prefer?
Depends on the city.
Yeah, usually cottages, I think, you know, just because the bang for the buck later on is much better. But, you know, once in a while, if the city would need a farm. But for the most part, I'd focus on cottages myself.
I prefer farms, but that's probably because I get into the mode in the early game to build farm improvements, and in the later games when cottages become an option, I'm concentrating on so many other things that when I see a grassland title, for example, I just instruct a worker to construct a farm right out of a habit. Though in cities that have tiles with rivers, I do manage to regularly mix in some water mills. At the same time, the larger the map I play on, the greater variety of city geographies I have or anybody has, and I find it easier to compare their performance, say particularly during war times when I need to crank out those offensive and defensive units, so I take extra care to specialize workers' action carefully. You know, with this the whole debate of farms or cottages, I mean, can you not go micromanagement crazy and go math crazy? I've seen people trying to do the math. And if you've listened to a previous pilot, you know Math and I? Watch it. Meet my eyes. Yeah, that's right. I'm staring you down, all right? But as a general rule, I say, know your city or your city's sizes and geographies. Some are favored to commerce producing, others production. I think you'll find it harder to find the latter type to support many cottages, while those with food excesses can support.
Yeah, if you have a city that has a bunch of hills around it, it makes more sense to put down farms so you can have everyone work the mines on the hills. Yeah. But if you've got a big place that's mostly grassland with a river running through it, you could actually, that one you could mix, because then you could also get enough farms for specialists, which can almost be better than the cottages.
And that's what I tend to do. I pick one or two cities that have a lot of food surplus and build specialists there and pretty much cottages everywhere else.
Bring on those engineers.
I prefer artists. Culture bomb is the coolest.
Well, they're all good, except for great merchants.
Well, they give plus one food if you settle them in a city, and that's very useful.
Oh, for the cities I have that always have odd numbers and I can never even them out.
For example.
One city, every game.
I tend to concentrate those in my great people cities so I can get even more great people.
So you don't just have great people, you have like superb people?
Something like that.
He's not satisfied with just your ordinary great people.
He wants super, super, super great people.
Okay, forest cutting.
Well, somebody's going to have to refresh me what the patch changed, because I haven't been cutting as much lately.
It cut, I guess, the yields a little bit, but I can't remember the exact numbers now.
Yeah, I think it was in half, but ooh, if you research mathematics, you get a little bit more again. I think the total is like, on Epic, it used to be 60, I think. And after the patch, it's 45, if I recall correctly. Don't remember the other game speeds.
Is that 45 after your mathematics?
Yeah, after mathematics. Before that, it's something like 20 or 25.
Yeah, that definitely does cut down on, you know, early cutting, most definitely, because, you know, a lot of people like to get that worker out there and try to get a, you know, cut a settler or something out real quick. So, I mean, they definitely wanted to combat that, obviously, and I believe it probably has changed a lot of people's strategies in doing that early cutting. You know, probably people are doing less of it overall as well because of the less yields from, I guess, an epic from 60 to 40.
We have strategies?
Oh. Yeah, strategy.
I don't know. I've read people have strategies.
Oh.
But of course, we know Dan's strategy is to win.
Of course.
That's right. I'm glad you remembered. I'll make a nice little notation in your forum profile.
Okay.
For me, you know, if a forest tile is within my city's borders to start, or if it's going to become within my city's border as my culture increases, which of course it always does because I'm me, I can cut it so, you know, I can convert those tiles into farms or cottages, probably farms, in consideration of long-term growth from the game. Lumber mills take far too long to come as far as I'm concerned, and I'm willing to wait for the engineering special ability. Sure, it's a nice production boost in the short term, but it's only the short term. And I don't want to wait until I anticipate I'm going to need or want help with, you know, to complete a rush job, unless there's, I don't know, a relatively early wonder I'm hankering for. I want those tiles working for me at their optimum as quickly as possible. No lazy tiles. Bad tiles. Bad. Bad. Don't look at me like that. Time out.
I do always try to make sure that I'm leaving them in even numbers, though, for the forest bonus later, if I know I'm going to keep them for lumber mills, but even then that's not but two or four, usually.
If a forest is never going to be in any radius of any city of mine, like overlapping, but still in my empire, I leave it alone, other than roading and then railroading it, so I want to keep that 50% defensive bonus, you know, while not making it a unit stopper, you know, actually have it so many units, any unit can go in and move out in the same turn. That's wonderful. Especially in the early to mid games. You know, you can't beat that defensive bonus. So forests, you do have some use. You know, it's hardly matched otherwise. Now that units cannot enter mountain terrain in Civ 4. Damn! Okay, I'm back.
Are you sure?
I'm over it. I'm over it. My first topic on the modcast this week says some people, we need a new game model without AI. For those who are not sure about that acronym, that's artificial intelligence. Spelled backwards, well, you can figure it out for your own, but we have to talk about this topic. So, what do you guys think? Yes? No? Maybe?
Well, the researcher, Spencer H., who suggested this, did suggest this, was because that would allow for a much more complicated game model, which I think sounds a lot better in theory than in practice. You would probably have a small audience for it, but you would never be able to sell like a million copies or more, as is the case for Civ 4. So it would be a very small game.
Yeah, you know, I think there are some games that can and should and do emphasize multiplayer over single player, but I disagree too that there should be no single-player component in the game. By doing this, you are eliminating, as Wetter was saying, so much of the market of those gamers like me who find it a perpetual hassle for one reason or another to schedule matches, be prepared to address those missing players and fill in substitute players or even getting enough players, and then at that, finding players that have enough of a variety of playing styles. And while I'm no multiplayer player, to me, the best games are those that find a happy medium between single-player and multiplayer support. You can't make everyone happy on either side. Why even try?
And let me add also to what Dan just said, you know, I bet, you know, if you want to play a game 5 years from now, I mean, if it's a single-player game, you just put it in and start playing. If it's a human-v-human game, you're not sure if anyone's still playing anymore, especially if you play at random weird times and... Also, I mean, in addition to that, if you just want to play little snippets at a time, say you want to play Civ in 20-minute increments, I'm not sure that you could find too many players who would be interested in something like that, but the AI sure is, because it doesn't care if how much you beat it around. So, you know, I think there's something to be said for having games that have multiplayer and single-player. Perhaps you'd find some audience for human v human games, but I don't think it'd be that huge with this concept. So, you know, I think the single player facet is very important.
I have nothing but ditto.
And you know, Spencer, you know, you're driving a point home to me that perhaps you probably didn't intend to. If game complexity is being, as you say, dumbed down in order for the AI to be competitive without too many cheats, then what do you think about reintroducing those cheats to a measure, not necessarily saying the same level as before, in order for human players to be challenged? But this could be something, you know, something to be said for making this some sort of a scalable option. Now, how are we going to make that scalable? How are we going to make that an option? I don't know. I'm the ideas guy, as we've been through before. But I'm trying to compromise with you here, Spencer, work with me. But you know, if ultimately you're just not listening to this, there are games very much like what you're wanting. They're called MMOs, or massively multiplayer online games. What do you think, Spencer?
Full of jerks. Yeah, we'll be substituting AI cheating with player cheating is what will happen.
Yeah, I don't think he is looking for something like EverQuest or World of Warcraft here. I think he's trying to bring back some multiplayer war games or something.
Yeah, the idea of like when you used to play Risk and you sat around the table with some people you knew and you could play it all in one go, but it's much harder to do that with a computer game.
Yeah, and if you're able to sit beside someone and play a game, it's much easier to hit them when you lose. Oh, wait.
Or when they turn away to do something to their pieces on the board. You know, you can't do that online.
No, see, that's what cheats are called.
Oh, cheats.
Hacks.
Such see, a loaded...
Hacks to the board game.
Such a loaded term.
Yes, cheats are just creative gameplay advantages.
Yes.
Let's be politically correct.
And misunderstood.
They sure are. I wouldn't want to be its therapist. Well, except for maybe the money. Woo, money!
All right, for the next modcast topic, we're going to discuss what we should put in for the next XP, Green Day 234. In the Paladin forums, felt that the next XP should take more of a diplomatic focus. We're going to discuss whether this is a good idea.
Yes. I can okay. expand on that, but, you know, just,
yeah, yeah,
that's settled.
Just to throw that out there.
Next topic.
I agree with Dan. I concur 100%.
Would you care to expound upon that?
Certainly. Focus number one, United Nations. You know, for me, within a century or two or thereabouts, the options are all but limited to, what is it, either re-electing Secretary General or whatever that one is where we're not trying to obtain the diplomatic victory. Can't remember if that's Secretary General or something else. Mm. That gets boring, especially when I win all the time. I mean, I know I'm a winner.
And you know. Once you've put all the, I forget what they're called...
I want to say provisions myself. Resolutions.
Yeah, that's it. Yes. Once you put all the resolutions through, then what good is it to do? It doesn't make much difference unless you get the AI who wants to all of a sudden start firing off nuclear weapons or something.
And actually, one of my favorite recommendations is if you can't get to that, you know, nuclear resolution to not use nukes, how about a nuclear arms reduction option or a general arms reduction? That would be good on the military side and perhaps on the economic side, tariffs for trade. And, you know, we could use a little bit more power and value for our spies, too.
Yeah, I don't know about the police actions part, though. I don't know. From a programming standpoint, I don't know how it would handle that without you being in there and them going, hey, what are you doing in our territory?
You weren't here a second ago. I mean, I think the UN should... you know, probably look at Alpha Centauri a little bit and look at how they did theirs. I mean, I think that was a really, you know, good way to run it. Perhaps go back to that and instead of having every three turns, you know, have the Secretary General introduce different you know, types of things. I mean, if you're the Secretary General, you know, you should have a little bit of power and to do kind of interesting things. A little more options. Also, I think that they should be able to defy the UN at some point, and some sort of embargo or something should be placed on a country that does do that. So, I mean, it's kind of weird to say the UN tells you can't do this, and then you just can't do it because, as we know in our real world example, I know I'm bringing in the real world horror, but you know, there's a lot of countries that say, well, we don't care. I think we should allow something like that to be in the game. Why not?
Especially for the resolutions where it's getting you to switch over in your civics. You may have your civics a certain way, and then somebody else is controlling the UN and wants to go all to, like, free market or something. There should be a way for you to say, I don't want to go free market.
Yeah. Well, you could say, I want to be a fascist guy, or I want to be a communist. Screw you and your free market. So, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, for you to be able to say, or even an AI player or another human player to say, you know what, I'm withdrawing from the United Nations.
Oh. Yeah, because it always amazes me when you put one of those resolutions through and everybody changes. And I'm going, why is nobody resisting this? There's at least two or three countries on the, you know, in this game I'm playing that would be telling me, hell no.
Yeah, that will be nice to see. Other ideas that I would like to see that I don't think have been discussed in this thread is maybe make it a little bit more interesting, because as you said, it's all about electing the president and then winning another vote, and then you've won. I would like to see more something like the UN moving towards like a European Union is today, to really unite different civs. And if you can create like a global government, then you've won a diplomatic victory. I think that would be more interesting.
Instead of just a simple vote for it?
Yeah. Just gradually integrate the civilizations.
And I also saw the suggestion about not quite so powerful United Nations, the suggestion of having like an intermediary League of Nations option. I'm not too keen on that myself.
It's just adding more complications. It doesn't really add anything new to the game. More of the same, or less of the same, as the case may be.
I do like Ray's also said that we could get in some new civic choices. Because we could still use some more expansion on them, you know. There's room on there.
Yeah, perhaps something like a, an emphasis or something like that, with pluses and minuses. You know, do you want to emphasize, use your bully pulpit to emphasize growth, or emphasize military or commerce or something like that? Perhaps a civic choice, you know, that indicates which direction you want your civ to go in terms of ideology or something like that. That could be some fun. Or not.
That was silence agreement. Silence and agreement.
Awkward silence is getting air time.
Yeah. Okay, and so finally on this week's Modcast, Naval Aspects in Civilization 4. What can we do to help them?
Navigable rivers.
Yes.
Oh. See earlier pilot.
Yes, I know.
Gunboats there, up of the river.
I will second Will 9's suggestion in the thread. Coast Guard National Wonder. And I'm not necessarily agreeing with his exact points, but I like the idea. He writes that it increases your naval unit strength within your borders and lets your coastal borders extend 4 squares. It would require combustion.
Mm.
Sounds good to me.
I also like the idea of bombing land tiles, you know, kind of battleships or whatnot, be able to act a little bit, like they are in real life, be able to bomb coastal tiles.
Yeah, I think that's the biggie. That really makes Navy an important thing to have, because most of these other ideas, yeah, they add a little bit of flavor, but not really fundamentally make Navy really important. And naval bombardment, which Cold Power already has, and also Dale Combat's mod, they really change the game. I think that would be fun to have.
And then for some reason, the person who started this thread goes, don't even get me started on planes. Well, I'll get started on something related. Helicopters. Man, you know, at the outset, I thought the ability to upgrade cavalry to helicopters was great. I think it's still great that you can upgrade cavalry, rather than having them, you know, go out in a blaze of glory or disband them or otherwise. But helicopters stink, at least in my experience.
No, they don't. You're good at intercepting units out in the open.
Okay, let me elaborate. They stink on what I want them to do, which is blow cities up.
Okay, you don't use helicopters to blow cities up. You use artillery and tanks to blow cities up. The helicopters hover there in the stack, and if anything comes close, they snipe out and go, I don't think so.
You're trampling on Dan's dream.
But the animations are so pretty.
That's what we do around here.
You're all banned and you're going to like it.
I might get more work done than me.
And so our audience might be thinking, how does this relate exactly to naval aspects? Later on in Civ, when those people are on those ships, however we want to call them, you know, they'll probably have internet access, so this is of interest to them. Don't forget the little people. We're so quick to talk about the units, but we never talk about the people.
Think they read Tommy?
They will if they know what's
they
good
wonder.
For them.
They wonder.
if you have any questions for us, you can send them to, what was it, Dan?
Polycast@apolton.net. That's PolyCast at apolton.net.
And if you really want to humor us, send us a voicemail, and we will play it on the air.
Reach us through our Skype account, the Polycast, by using Skype yourself. The call is free. Download Skype from skype.com, skype.com. You can also phone us if you prefer. In North America, call 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, call 44-20-7871-7659. That's 44-20-7871-POLY. No profanity or hate mail, please. Before we go, I got your message about my account being frozen and I need to enter my information to access it, but I couldn't access my account in the first place because apparently I don't have one. I'm sorry.
Oh, I've been getting that from all the time now. And some German bank, but I don't speak German, so I guess it's the same.
Nope.
So if you would open an account for me and then lock it, I'd be glad to unlock it.
I think somebody over there who's quiet is surfing prawn.
Again? Still?
Yes, I'm sorry.
You better at least be searching for new sites. You should keep visiting the old ones. After a while, it's going to get kind of boring.
That's why they update them every week.
Yes.
Only every week? Man.
Or sooner. I don't know what sites he goes to.
He goes to, you know,
just my
girls playing Civ.
Wow.
Wait, there's no webcam around here, is there?
this week we're having one of our models invade India.
And by invade, you mean...
You fill in the blank, Dan.
Well, folks, that was our show for this week of a Polycast. Once again, the official podcast of a Apolton Civilization site at apolton.net. I would like to thank those who joined me, or I joined them, however we want to say it or think of it. I see if I can get all the names, because I was having problems with that earlier. Imran.
Yes, and I wish all of you a great civving week.
Yes, I'm glad you're able to get your computer problems sorted out. Man.
Yeah, and you know, these the guys at didn't even charge me a cent for it. I placed the motherboard, and you know, even though it says in the warranty it's not covered under electrical strikes, I didn't have to pay a dime. So hey, good for me.
But next time it thunders that bad, please unplug your computer.
Well, I was asleep at the time. I didn't know.
Oh, well, okay, your excuse.
Oh, now, I thought we talked about before that sleeping was overrated, but eating was not. So bad, Imran.
Well, see, he wasn't here for that.
Exactly, so now I know.
Excuses, excuses. Was that the name?
That was.
If you would like to sponsor the show, so your name
now
doesn't get bleeped out.
Many times.
Now I'm going to bleep out your name unless you sponsor us. But if I bleep out your name, then how would you know to sponsor us? What a vicious cycle this show is.
It's so evil. It is.
It's just Dan that's evil.
No, I'm the victim. I'm always ganged up on. It's because I'm the owner.
It's our job description.
And I'm the man, you know.
Wait a minute.
Record date September 29th, 2006. Edited by Daniel Dan Q. Quick. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization 4 and Warlords Expansion Pack. Copyright 2006, Apolton Civilization site at apolton.net.